Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants will be on listen-only until the question-and-answer session of today's conference, at which time you may press star one to ask a question. Today's conference is being recorded, and if you object, you may disconnect at this time. Thank you.
Welcome, everyone, to the sixth in our new series of Watch Lectures. I'm very pleased to be able to introduce Stefan Savage from the University of California, San Diego. Stefan has done some just remarkable work in a couple of areas and, as a byproduct, occasionally created some interesting discussions inside NSF about who should buy cars and things like that. He graduated from the University of California, sorry, University of Washington, got his PhD there, and joined the San Diego Jacobs School of Computer Science and Engineering in January 2001. And since then, he's just done a whole lot of really interesting things. He's not actually going to talk about any of those things today, as far as I know, but rather a topic that I think is very provocative and particularly appropriate for this series, which is why the hard problem of computer security needs the soft sciences. Stefan.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. So first off, I want to be clear that this is the work that I described today will be work that I was present for, but was actually done by the amazing cast of characters listed here, graduate students, staff, and faculty who've been working together for a bit over a decade. To give people a little bit of context about myself first, because there are a number of faces in the audience that I don't recognize, and so I assume it's not just my lack of memory and that I haven't met you before. Let me give you some background about who I am and how it relates to the talk I'm going to give today. So I co-direct an effort called the Collaborative Center for Internet Epidemiology and Defenses, which is a mouthful, which is one of the NSF Cyber Trust Centers, just winding down. And we were created in response to the worm threat. You may remember at the turn of the century, we had the first big worm outbreaks on the internet, Code Red and Slammer and so forth. And so to address that, actually, our group started to get together, and eventually funded by NSF in 2004. And through that, actually, we're able to build a fairly sizable activity. We get support now also from ONR for aspects of this work and a lot of industrial support, primarily in kind in terms of data and so forth, but it allows us to do quite a bit. And so the context here is when we got into this, we had a number of goals for our work. Right? One is what we called internet epidemiology. We wanted to be able to measure and understand the kinds of attacks that were confronting internet users, and we wanted to come up with a quantitative methodology that would allow us to describe the growth of viruses and worms and so on and so forth. Then, based on that understanding, we wanted to build automated defenses because now we wanted to protect, understand and protect. That's what we thought computer security was about. In writing the proposal, there is this section about broader impacts. And so I will be honest, in pure lip service to our broader impact, we also said that we were going to look at a bunch of other things, the economic, social, and legal issues. And we had a lawyer on staff, and we figured she would write some legal stuff. And that would be a checkbox item for us. And part of why I'm here today is because I think a number of years through the effort, we decided that, in fact, that thing that was a boilerplate item for us was, in fact, by far the most important aspect of the work, and that this other stuff was perhaps not as important as we thought it was, the technical aspect going in. So just to give you some context, after a few years doing this, we had a lot of successes by traditional metrics of success, right? So we had a lot of papers in journals and conferences. We had built big systems. Just a couple examples. So UCSD runs this thing called the Network Telescope. 1% of all routable addresses actually come through there. So anything that happens on large scale using random addresses on the internet, like worm spreading or denial of service attacks, we're able to observe a lot of them. Pretty much all of the measurements of worm growth that anyone did used either this data or this methodology. We had for a long time the largest active honey farm, I think at least that was public, There are 250,000 live virtual hosts, so that things that were out there to get infected so we could find out what was new. We built a system that could recognize worm signatures in under a millisecond. That got spun out to Cisco. It's in the Catalyst series devices. We did a lot. By all of these metrics, we were a successful enterprise. But, right, we reflected on our time doing this, and it was not the case that things were getting better, all right? And so we did not, in fact, stop worms from spreading, and we didn't stop malware, and we didn't stop e-crime, and it wasn't that we were lousy. I mean, we might have been. There might have been better people. But it wasn't just that we were lousy. No one else was accomplishing this goal either, right? That, in fact, if you were to ask the layperson on the street, are you more secure than you were 5 years ago, you know, reprising previous presidential debate, they would say, no, of course not. I'm reading about all this terrible stuff that's happening. I think anyone giving you an unvarnished, independent opinion would say, yes, that the situation has gotten worse, not better. And so the conclusion that we came to, which is really what I'm here to talk to you about today, is that the key mistake here that we made, and that, in fact, most of the security community, both in industry and research, I think, makes, is looking at this as a purely technical problem, that there are a set of holes and dikes that if only they could be plugged up, that we would have a solution. All right. So This is somewhat unfair, but I think does characterize some aspect of the state of the practice today, which is that we find new problems, and then we try to beat them down as quickly as we can, and we eventually lose. All right, it's just like the game of whack-a-mole. And why, you might ask, is it this way? Why are we stuck in this kind of game? And I think in part it's because of the way we have set the game up for ourselves. So I'm going to talk about a number of asymmetries that exist in the way the computer security game, where game is meant in the most serious sense of the word game, operates. So the very first one that I think most people are familiar with is the asymmetry of initiative. So as defenders, we are fundamentally reactive. We find out about a new attack or a new class of attack or a new kind of attack. Someone invents a new kind of fraud. We have to react, all right? By contrast, attackers can attack precisely when they want to, and this manifests in a number of significant advantages for attackers. So the simplest one of these advantages to describe is the one that goes to malware. So if you were to go to an antivirus company and ask them what percentage of malware do you detect, they will tell you 99 point whatever percent. And there is a measure under which that is true, but from the standpoint of does it detect the new malware that someone has released, the answer is absolutely not. The answer for anyone, for any kind of malware written by someone who doesn't totally suck, all right, the answer is 0%. 0% is detected. And the reason 0% is detected is definitional. It is that they all have access, because this is over-the-counter software, to the antivirus products. And there are services that they use that are catered to the criminal underground that will test their malware to see if it gets detected or not, and they do not release it until it is not detected. And so by definition, they only choose to release when it is not detected. The detection rate has to be zero, just because of the way we've set up the game. Another asymmetry we have is on the innovation side. New defenses tend to be much more expensive than new attacks. Some of that is technical. It tends to be a lot harder to build recognizers than to build obfuscators. But some of it as well is economic. So when you are building a company in a space, you have a lot of sunk costs in a particular business model. So if you are selling a particular kind of product, and you can see this from people who, in response to the big worm outbreaks, a lot of people built software to try to defend against these kinds of things. Then Microsoft added the firewall to Windows, an XPSP 2 in 2002. And in a very short period of time, a matter of months, the bad guys figured out really quickly, well, we could probably get around this, but it's much easier just to shift our base of operations to the web, and we will come up with exploits that will attack your browser, and we'll just have you come to them instead of sending them to you. And if you were to talk to people in the companies who are building this other kind of software, they would say, that's not our problem, right? That's web security, which apparently there's a new kind of security that had been invented right then and there. And so there's about 2 years in which startups get created in web security before they get bought and absorbed, and that you could expect a product that you buy would actually do something about this class of threat. So they can respond very, very quickly, and it's harder for us just institutionally to change this way for lots of reasons, both technical and economic. We have an asymmetry of incentives. Generally speaking, there's low risk to attack. Some of this is kind of the old saw that because we have kind of a lot of anonymity, there's not much deterrence. But there's another aspect to this as well, which is that security is, generally speaking, not a key competitive feature. Right? And this is even true of security products. And the reason for this is the last one, which is asymmetry and evaluation. We do not have any meaningful way to talk about the security that a product offers. Right? How many quatloos of security does Symantec offer versus McAfee? Right? Which one offers more security? We just don't know. That's not to say they don't work really hard on improving the security of their products, but it is not built into the way that this works that we can tell. As a result, you know, it's a dirty secret of the security industry. They compete on every aspect of the product that they sell except the security that they offer because they can't compete on security. It's not possible to compete on security. So the end result is that you compete on performance and on marketing and things like that. On the flip side, for the attackers, particularly the economically motivated attackers, it's very easy to measure how well you're doing. Do you make more money? They use exactly the same criteria that Amazon uses for a redesign on their web page. We swizzled this a little bit. Did we make more money? Then that's a good UI feature. Right? They do the same thing. I did this to my malware. I made more money. It's Darwinian. It just gets better. It just gets better and better and better because they have a very easy way to evaluate. So if we were to go back and reflect, given this, we spend, depending on whose made up numbers you believe, somewhere in the, you know, $50 to $75 billion a year worldwide on IT security, primarily spent on the goal of securing the end host, right? Making sure that my laptop and your server are not compromised in some way. And that's everything from AV and firewalls to security reviews to programming languages, you know, all this kind of stuff. Now the downside with our focus being there is that this is probably the single most expensive front to secure because it's all of the 2 billion PCs that exist. And they are being administered by individuals who have incentives that have nothing to do with your definition of security as an outside third party. So you are counting on 2 billion people that are administered by, like, my dad to actually stay secure. And so we can turn this question around and say, well, how valuable are these hosts that we are spending all this money to secure to the bad guys? Let's suppose they want to buy some hosts. Well, how would you know that? Well, it turns out that there's a great market. At any given time, there are about 25 organizations that are selling compromised hosts in what's called the paper install market. This is one that's now out of business called Installed for Sale. And they will list prices here for hosts in different countries. These prices are somewhat out of date, but ballpark, about $100 for U.S. hosts, and now it's down to about $5 to $8 for Asian hosts. And, oh, to be absolutely clear, that is per thousand hosts. All right? Everything on the underground is in units of 1,000. So the value of a host is, in fact, at most a dime to them, and probably under a penny for a large fraction of them. So, now, that's not to say there aren't individual hosts that have enormous value, but this huge disparity in how much we generally spend on every host versus how much it's worth suggests that, in fact, there's something going on here that we are not fully understanding. All right. Just to be clear, this is true for everything. So these are prices for 1,000, like, Hotmail accounts or Gmail accounts. We, in working with a mail provider 2 weeks ago, we bought, I think it was 35 million accounts for $350. Right? So it's a total free-for-all out there, and this stuff is not worth very much. And these weren't even, like, new accounts. These were, like, people's accounts. All right. So what should we do? All right. People know that things are bad. And so one refrain that I've often heard, particularly in D.C., is, you know what we need? You know what we really need? We need science. It's time to apply some science to this, because we know that science is good and it can fix everything, because this is, you know, truth, justice, and science is how we solve these problems. And I don't disagree with this, actually. All right. But then the question is, what kind of science? right? What do we mean? But science is part of the reason that this, you know, this is funny is because everyone says let's do science, and they don't know what the hell they mean when they say that. All right. So let's reflect on this. So one version, and I don't want to be absolutely clear that I think all of these are actually good approaches. I just think that the one I'm going to talk about today has gotten short shrift. So one approach is that let's look at this like math. All right, that there is, think about security as having an axiomatic basis. There are some things that we're going to define a policy, and once we define a policy and once we have an axiomatic basis for how computers operate, then we'll devise principles and implement them, and we'll be able to prove that the system is secure. All right, and there are great examples of this working. Among them are cryptography is kind of in this realm. Type theory is a huge success story in this realm. And the beauty of this is once you actually define the set of policies you want to enforce and if you can push it through your formal system, that you actually, subject to those particular things you care about, you have some kinds of strong guarantees.
It doesn't work for everything.
Another approach is, all right, let's think about this like a physical science, all right? It's not that this is axiomatic, but there's some kind of platonic truth. There's some truth out there. And we are going to discover it through experimental measurement, and then we're going to generalize, and that this will tell us, you know, how well this particular property holds. I think a fairly good example of this is biometrics, right? You go in, you say, we believe that there's this distinguishing characteristic, and if we measure well enough, then we know how strong that distinguishing characteristic is across a certain set of populations and so forth. And then that tells us how well we can expect this to work in a statistical sense and feel comfortable with it. The third one, which is what I'm going to talk about, is like a social science, all right? And that is, it is not the case that these are platonic or axiomatic truths, but they're contextual truths. This is a socially constructed system that we live in. We can discover those contextual truths experimentally through both controlled experiment and through field work, and that some of them are, in fact, generalizable in a way that you might use them to either make predictions or to make interventions that would improve your life. All right. So let's take a step back. I'm going to try to justify why it is that I think that the social science aspect is one that is particularly fruitful. So whenever you corner a computer security researcher and ask them what security is about, they say, well, it's about how do you provide some kind of functionality in the presence of an adversary. So implicitly, we have an adversary, and we are in conflict with the adversary, right? Absent conflict with an adversary, we don't care about security. We just don't do it, and then we're fine. So for us to care, we need conflict, and we need an adversary. So kind of to paraphrase Charlton Heston, it's people, right? Security is people, right? Because all of the people who are involved, we tend to think of the adversary as this, the computer security community, I think, inheriting from crypto, tends to think about these things very informally. We have, you know, we have Alice and Bob and Eve, and they have arbitrary or abstractly defined powers. But in fact, our adversaries are real people. They have real motivations and capabilities, and they have organizations that shore up the ways that they operate and in what context they do. Our victims, in part because they have particular behaviors and limitations. Our defenders are limited in what they can do because they have incentive structures that guide what they do. And so while this particular situation, computer security, has a conflict that is mediated by computers, that it goes through computers, it is not driven by computers. It's social and political and economic forces. And so in the end, why would we ever believe that we're going to solve this entirely in the computer domain? Right? In fact, the hypothesis that we're going to advance is that you're going to do much, much better in addressing security problems if you actually understand what these forces are. And I'm going to give some examples today of how that's so. Just, you know, to make some analogies, it would be so bizarre if computing was the one place in which you could solve what is really a problem of human conflict entirely in a technical way. We don't expect that some technology is going to solve our need to have wars, our criminal justice problem. I mean, the analogy I've made at times is, yeah, let's solve crime by making better highways. Because, you know, criminals drive on highways, and therefore, you know, it's clear that technology is a critical piece, but it's not going to solve the problem any more than building a really good fence is going to solve the drug problem, right? There are some deeper issues here. All right, so the remainder of the talk, I'm going to focus on one particular area that we know a fair amount about, which is the spam ecosystem. At the very end, I'll talk about how this actually applies in a whole lot of cases. I'm going to first give you some background for how the underground works and what's the economic and business structure for the spam that you get in your email, and then talk about how one goes about reasoning about what one might do about this problem. So just to give you guys a little bit of background, the worm thing was actually a big turning point in computer security. So in the 21st century, we have three big technical changes that then that allow these other economic changes to take place. So one is we get efficient large-scale compromise through things like worms and viruses. It becomes possible for you to take over large numbers of hosts in short periods of time. We get centralized control. We pull back access to all those hosts to a central point, so now you can control them as a single entity, as like the cloud, as it were, but the kind of the dark cloud. And then probably the most important version is we get applications that are profit-driven. All right, so we get applications that either try to monetize the commodity resources on a PC, like their bandwidth or their address and so forth, or unique credentials like your bank account. The big change comes about, there's actually like, I would argue the single biggest moment in at least pragmatic computer security happens in 2004 when these guys who were running this, SoBig and MyDoom, which were basically these worms, they didn't do anything. They just took over machines, cut a deal with a spammer. And the problem was at this time that we were successful in keeping spammers from delivering mail by creating blacklists of the hosts that they were using to send mail. And having done that, they now needed a way to launder the origin from which they were sending this mail. They cut a deal with these guys. They say, when you take over the host, how about you put in a little proxy so I can bounce mail through it? And so it allows them to launder their point of origin. This changes absolutely everything because all of a sudden, now these guys are getting paid for doing what before was just a joyriding activity. And they can get paid more the more hosts they take over and the longer period, which is what I have been told our economists call a virtuous economic cycle, which I find very ironic considering the context. In a very, very short period of time, this creates a commodity market for compromised hosts. And by commodity market, I mean like what I showed before. They're sold in lots of a thousand. You can pay differential pricing based on where they are. I want that mill host. I want whatever. I want high uptime hosts, high bandwidth hosts. They're value-added tiers. You know, let a thousand flowers bloom. You get a very dynamic market. And so what happens is you get innovation in the substrate, which is these compromised hosts controlled from a central entity, and this really creates a platform economy. And so from the standpoint of online economically motivated criminals, it is totally reasonable for them to think about just buying hundreds of thousands of hosts as a platform for them to base some kind of fraudulent activity on. And then all of these, basically every bad thing you know about on the Internet, whether it's phishing or spam or info theft or whatever, these are all vertical market applications that are built on top of the same platform. I'm not going to go through all this. We spend a lot of time studying this underground market. And the ones in green are the one we have active projects studying. But basically, they fall into these, the aspects of this activity fall into this category of one, acquiring illicit goods, whether they're like your bank account or your computer or what have you, a market for trading with others so that you can expand, you can do more, and you can lower costs by having a wider set of people that you're collaborating with. Scams, which would, in a normal economy, be called entrepreneurial activity, because this is where you add capital to these resources to create new money. And then liquidation, which is the trickiest part, where you actually get cash out in the end. And so in some cases, it's advertising-based. So there's a lot of stuff going on here. I mean, we tried to break things down into categories. I think we had 120 categories of different goods and services. But at the end of the day, there are two value creation strategies that exist, all right? And there are probably a couple counterexamples that I invite you to think about. But almost everything falls either into advertising, that is monetized through advertising, or is monetized through theft. And it is a spectrum. So, like, clearly advertising is good spam, people selling you Viagra, and clearly theft is they steal your credit card and fake antivirus is somewhere in between. You actively participate, but you're being defrauded and so forth. This, in turn, like that, all the new capital comes from these schemes. This, in turn, funds everything that I would call infrastructure. So everything from botnets to banking trojans to underground virtual private networks to hide from the police. There's a huge activity here that is funded through that capital because that's the market for these services are the people who are doing this. We're going to focus on the left-hand side, in particular, on advertising and spam. All right, so first I'm going to give you a picture of how a modern spam campaign works. This is a real-life example. You've seen this one before, kind of. So this is an example from a couple years ago, the real-life example. Actually, the Grum botnet deposits this email in our mailbox advertising online pharmaceuticals. It's not actually important that this is email. All right, we call this the advertising phase. It can also be search. It can be Twitter. It can be Facebook. The important part is that it gets a link out in front of a potential customer and tries to coerce them to click on it. So having clicked, then a whole bunch of other things need to happen. You need to have that click take them to a site that they can actually purchase from. We call this click support, and there are a lot of moving pieces. So first they need a registrar for this domain that they've asked you to click on. In this case, it was a registrar in Russia who was mass registering domains of questionable value. They need a name server to actually host this domain. In this case, it was a name server in China. Then they need a website to actually host the content. In this case, it was a compromised host in Brazil that did not actually host the content, but was a proxy that reached back to an affiliate network in Moscow, run by a jailed child molester, of all things. And now you can get to the site and purchase the goods, but there's a third phase. They need to be able to take your money and deliver the goods if you think they do that. And so we call this the fulfillment phase. And so what's happened is this particular affiliate program has cut a deal with an Azerbaijani bank in Baku to accept Visa payments on behalf of the customers of this activity. And they have cut a deal actually through a middleman, but the picture gets too complex, with a set of factories in India who then drop ship goods back to the person. Now, the important part of this picture, every single one of these lines has to work for them to make money on that spam message. If any one of those lines were intercepted, you could not make money. And so the question that I'll ask you to be thinking about in the back of your head as we go on is, what line should we cut? Where should we put our money to try to stop this problem? Right now, where we spend most of our money is trying to keep from getting the spam to begin with. All right? And I'll tell you that, again, it's the most expensive place to put your money, because it's really easy to send a lot of spam, and it's very easy for them to eventually get past the filters because they get accounts on the same sites and send mail to themselves until they modify it until they can get through the filters. All right. So let's talk a little bit about the actors. So remember, we have these three phases I talked about. The advertising phase is almost uniquely done by the spammer. The spammer is not selling goods. They are an independent contractor who is an advertiser. All right? They're an affiliate of what's called an affiliate program, which I'll go into in more detail. They also sometimes handle the click support phase, setting up the domains and so forth. The realization phase is almost entirely handled by an organization called an affiliate program. And this is an evolution of this business structure. This, if you were to go back and look at how spam worked 5, 10 years ago, the one person would do everything. They'd be soup to nuts. We now have division of labor because it ends up being much more effective. And sometimes you'll have third parties. All right. So let's talk briefly about affiliate programs. So the way this works is they're kind of like a franchise business for advertisers. They hire advertisers as independent contractors. They provide content, the web pages and so forth, the back-end engine for processing orders. They handle payment services, so they have a relationship with payment processors and banks. They handle fulfillment, that is getting, you know, whoever delivers the goods or services, and they provide customer service, which actually, you know, they provide actually quite good customer service, and that actually ends up being somewhat important. They are paid on a commission basis. So for pharmaceuticals, it's between, say, 35 and 50% of the net that comes in from a customer order. Here's an example of an affiliate program. This is one called RX Promotion. It was run by Pavel Grubielski, who's now actually in jail in Moscow. The program has since been shut down. Among the things that they this is a pharmaceutical program. Their program is for almost anything you can imagine, but pharma, probably as your experience goes looking in your inbox, is a pretty big one for spam. And so they advertise a number of things. One of them, they'll advertise that they have different commission structures, so they'll compete on the price of drugs. They have parties for their people. They have various kinds of incentives for selling the most or selling things in particular categories. And then they offer cash out through independent online currencies. They also let you run your own shops. They have a whole bunch of different templates. These all kind of look like they're different. There'll be whole websites around this theme, but they're, in fact, all just geared towards different market segments. So if you're selling Viagra to the elderly versus to the young, if you're selling Schedule II opiates, you know, you will have different marketing content that goes along with that. All right. So there's a bunch of different questions one might ask about this. One set of questions that go on how, what does this business model look like and how good is it and how much money are we talking about? And the other is, given this, how should we intervene? We've done a lot of work. I'm only going to be able to talk about snippets of it, but I'm going to give you some flavor for the kinds of work that one can do in this space to understand this problem from an economic context and from the standpoint of actually understanding who the actors are and how they're made. Quick aside, because Doug Mann gave a talk last time. And we ended up, we always get called out for some reason. And I think part of it is because we are frequently developing new methods, and in particular new methods that involve, you know, direct engagement. So we purchase from criminals and so forth. And so I wanted to be actually very clear, particularly in the light of Doug's talk, that we pay more attention to this than almost anybody. And so in the list of oversight, we have a human subjects review. We have our own lawyer, who in fact is the lawyer who co-wrote Doug's report, that we pay. We have then two independent lawyers who we check her opinion on, vice chancellor of research. We have general counsel, who we're on very good basis with, and we have sign-off from the UC System-Wide Office of Research Compliance. We are the most overseen research group that I think you have come through here in computer science in a long time. So, you know, I think perhaps we could do more on legal and ethics, but we do about as much as I think could be humanly expected and still get work done. All right. So given that, let's get back to talking about spam. The first issue with all this is demand, right? So this stuff would only happen because someone wants it. Someone has to actually click on this stuff and pay for it. Otherwise, you can't make any money doing it. So there's latent demand out there. I've yet to meet a person personally who says, oh, yeah, I buy my drugs online from Russian pharmacies. And so we might ask ourselves, where is this coming from? And so there's a case study, actually, appears in 2011, looking at this. And here we are particularly aided. So we're a very opportunistic group. We take data from anyone who will give us data and then try to figure out how much we can figure out about the world from that. In this particular case, one of the peculiar things about this pharmaceutical program, which is one of the largest, it's called EVA Pharmacy, it used to be called Bulker.biz, is that to save on hosting costs, they host the images on the site on compromised machines, so they don't have to pay for the bandwidth. And so it's a very particular structure, and we hunted down a bunch of these compromised machines and then contacted their administrators and said, your machine has been infected, it's hosting pictures of Viagra pills. Would you be willing to share the logs with us? And we found a taker, and this allowed us to basically look at every visit to one of these sites that anyone had made for, I think, about a period of 5 days. So when someone visits one of these pages, it pulls the main part of the page from an affiliate program, but then pulls all the images from one of these 5 compromised servers of which we now have logged. When they then go and pick a product, there's a separate set of images on the product page. So that allows us to see what product page they have gone to. When they then select a particular product, there are yet again some distinct images that appear on the selected product page. And there's yet another image that gets picked when they click on checkout. So by building basically a parser that looks at these images, and the data that we received was the source IP address was anonymized and it was replaced with a city. So that's all we have pretty much to work with. But we can tell here's what some person in this city looked at and then chose to put in their cart and then said, I want to check out. Now, we don't know. Maybe they never provided their credit card information, but they showed a fair amount of intent. So we're getting intent to the point of set checkout. So we get 752,000 distinct ICs who are visiting, and they make about 3,100 distinct additions to their shopping carts that they then want to check out from. And so what you find, everyone on the planet is visiting this site, but then if you restrict this to who is in fact trying to purchase something, it's much smaller, and it is much more concentrated. So in fact, what you end up finding, 75% of all customers are in the U.S., 91% are from Western countries. This is an activity that is funded with Western money. All right? So it is a negligible amount of money that is not coming from the West. So we also know what is getting purchased. All right? And so there's some interesting things here. So it's not too surprising that a whole lot is erectile dysfunction drugs. And then there are also, we place in the recreational category, things that are abused. All right? So things like opiates and stimulants and so forth. That is the the lion's share of what is out there. But there is a long tail, right? There is about a third that are for things that are either acute or chronic conditions. They're like real conditions that people are buying stuff for. And these include, I mean, we find AIDS medication, we find cancer medication, we find diabetes medication, you know, all over this. Now, so then, oh, yeah, so we've actually done this net since for a number of pharmacies, and there are three clusters that always come out, which is ED, opiate stimulants, and then chronic meds. We can then break this down by country of origin. All right, and so let's just look at Western countries, all right, not from the United States. And so what you find is 92% fall in the recreational category, and 8% are these kind of chronic meds. If you look at U.S. orders, this is where all those other things come from, all right? So people in the United States are four times more likely to buy normal medications than in these other countries, which perhaps this is not the reason, but actually subsidize the cost of drugs for their citizens. And so I think one of the things that you can find out of this kind of research are these structural aspects of what's going on on the victim side who are participating. All right. So let's talk about business model. For the spammer, this is the same. This is direct mail. It's the same business model. So as long as the advertising cost is less than the conversion rate times the marginal revenue, you make money. Same business model as L.L. Bean. Advertising costs. We know. We can either figure out what it costs retail, which is about $60 per million sent out on the underground. It's probably much less, though, for the guys who do this en masse, because they just it's the cost to run a botnet, and so it's what's your skilled labor cost in the country in which you operate, which is low. So it's like a guy. Marginal revenue, average sale is $100 to $200, commission in the neighborhood of 40%. Conversion is tricky, and so we did a study in 2008 doing an active measurement in this space where we found for one campaign that they got one successful conversion for 3 million messages delivered. I think it's conservative because of some methodological problems we had in the study, but even at that rate, we figured out that they could be pulling in about $3 million a year in revenue. So it's for that campaign. Now, the business model for the affiliate program is a little bit different. So first, the affiliate program model is absolutely brilliant because it transfers all of the risk, both in advertising and in innovation, to the advertisers. They're the ones who need to figure out how to deliver this advertising. You don't have to. If they don't do a good job, that's fine. They don't make any money. In fact, a lot of the affiliates don't make any money. In fact, so we have data from inside one of these programs. 90% of the revenue comes from 15% of the affiliates. It's heavy-tailed, like almost everything else. Cost structure, the commissions are the single biggest cost. Supply is about 15% of revenue. Another 15% goes for payment processing, which is incredibly expensive if you think about it. A normal discount rate on this should be like, I don't know, 200 basis points. Gross margins are actually not that big, right? If you were a venture capitalist, you would not want to invest in something with gross margins between 10 and 20%. On the other hand, these are largely operating out of countries in which there is no meaningful alternative with their skill set to engage in the Western market, and so this is actually maybe quite a bit better than what's available to them. All right. So how much total revenue? I'm going to go through this really quick because I want to get to the end. Remember I said they have customer service? All right, so we've placed quite a few orders now. We've placed over 500 orders from online sales, not using federal money. To be clear, this is one of the many places that industrial partners come in handy. So one of the interesting things you get is you get these order numbers, your order number, blah, 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 blah. And we noticed when we would make multiple orders from different versions of the same program, we'd get these order numbers. So here it's like 482065, then it's 483939, then it's 20. They're all going up, all right? And so you can, you have this hypothesis. We're scientists, so we call it a hypothesis, the sequential update hypothesis, that they just have a global variable. They increment every time someone makes a sale. If this were true, then you could make a purchase at time T, figure out that the order number was, say, 4,200, and then infer, having made a second purchase later at 4,224, through the power of subtraction, that in fact there have been 23 other orders that were not your own that were placed. And so, in fact, we did a whole bunch. We got basically two-thirds of all the pharmaceutical programs and most of the counterfeit software programs to have this characteristic. We did a huge amount of work validating that this is true. And I'll just, instead of going through it all, it's true. From this, you can actually get revenue estimates, all right? Because you say, all right, let's look at various estimates of what the marginal revenue per sale is. We know how many sales are going on, and you get these numbers that range from a few hundred thousand dollars per month to a couple $1 million per month. And in two of the cases, we actually have ground truth data, and that is because a lot of these organizations have not escaped the WikiLeaks meme, and so there's a huge amount of data that they have. They attack each other and leak each other's data. And so in some cases, like, we have, like, their financial statements. And it's basically within a small constant factor of what the prediction is. So in the end, you know, this is like a $100 million business, maybe two, but not more than that. So how big that is depends on where you're coming from. All right. So in the remaining time, though, I want to focus on what we should do. So we've done work before looking at CAPTCHAs, which is fascinating because it turns out that solving those little captures of those little obfuscated puzzles you need to solve online, that, in fact, that has engaged a market of third-world labor. That's how those all get solved. We were able to establish what the market demographics were, who those people were, how much they were making, what countries they worked in, and so forth. And we've done stuff with takedowns at the registrar level. But I want to talk about our most recent work, which was we call the click trajectory effort. And the idea was, remember all those lines that went into monetizing this activity? All right, so can we go and look at the full value chain for every one of these messages and see where are the bottlenecks? And by bottleneck, I mean if we were to intervene in one of those lines, there are two kinds of things we're looking at, which is how many resources at that tier would we need to eliminate to have the most impact on profitability? Are there thousands of registrars we need to take down or just two? And then the other question is, what's the switching cost? So having taken those resources away from them by intervening either in a technical or an extra technical means, would it be easy for them to just obtain substitutes? So are there lots of alternatives, and what's the cost to switch to an alternative? And so we do this. We are hardcore empiricists, so we have a huge cluster that basically crawls all spam and then tries to purchase from it. And so I'll walk through that. We do this for three domains, which dominate which, aside from pornography, which we decided for institutional reasons not to tackle, dominate the spam market. So we have a lot of different feeds of spam, which we get from commercial partners. We also have a honey farm through a project that we do with ONR that allows us to run all of these botnets and look at all of the spam that they're sending. From all of these, we extract the URLs that are embedded. And then we have a set of crawlers, one that comprehensively crawls all the name server infrastructure. And this deals with all kinds of kind of low-level issues like FastFlux. Basically, figure out all of the servers that are supporting their ability to reach this site. And then we have a web crawler that actually goes to every single one of these pages, renders the page. We save all that. We have a 20-terabyte database that then holds every single thing that happens. We then take this data and cluster it. So if the pages are structurally similar, if they look the same, then we'll cluster them together. So all of the different pages that have exactly the same brand and storefront get put in the same bins. And then we have a technique called content tagging, where we take those and we associate them directly with the organization, with the business entity that is sponsoring that. And I would like to tell you that we did this through some very advanced technique. And I can't. What I will tell you is that it was a huge amount of manual work, in some cases by actually getting stuff from within these programs that they provide to their affiliates and seeing these are all the options, in some cases by going through by hand, in other cases going to partners. We now actually have a machine learning approach to doing this, but this was literally like a week of solid, like 12 hours a day work. But at the end, and just to reiterate why this is the case, so here's a whole bunch of different storefronts you may see. These are all the same organization. All right? And so it's important for you when you're doing this kind of analysis to understand, all right, what organization are you dealing with, not just what veneer they have put up. So at the end, we may not have covered every single affiliate program, but we covered every one that matters. All right? So the amount of spam email that was not in a program that we were able to accurately characterize was very small. All right. So then, for each of these programs, we do selective purchasing, all right? And that is, we make purchases of goods from instances, multiple instances in each of the programs, And so you might ask, why would you do that purchasing? It's, you know, aside from being kind of salacious and sexy and so forth, what do you actually get out of it from a scientific standpoint? And you actually turn out to get a huge amount. So one is you get a lot of information about payments. So we actually cut a special deal with a credit card issuer. So we have our own credit cards that get issued to. We get a single credit card issued for each transaction we make, and we get transactional data for the entirety of the purchase. And that allows us to tell what bank is the most important. There's a lot of information we get, but the most important piece of information we get is what is a merchant bank that this organization is using in order to receive their payments. On the fulfillment side, we find out, first of all, are you receiving anything? Which it turns out, I mean, I think it's, are you in a fraud game or are you in a business? And then there's a bunch of issues about, you know, where it's shipped from, what's the content of the order, and so forth. Quick aside, this is actually turns out to be far harder to do than we ever thought. There are tons of operational issues in placing this kind of purchasing. You end up needing to escape their credit card fraud detection. You need to have your IP address co-located with the address of your credit card. You have to have email addresses that are not from, like, public. You can't have a Hotmail email address. It needs to be from a real place. You need distinct credit cards. There are cases where you need to have currencies that are not, they're basically offshore online currencies. In one case, we had to get a relative to go into Russia to, like, get instances of this currency. It's far harder than we ever thought. And then, as you might imagine, when you go to your institution and explain that you want to make purchases from criminals, the very first question I got, why can't they take a PO like everyone else? I swear to God. The first reaction that I got. And so we spent about a year doing trust building to get to the point. We are on a great basis at this point with everyone in our administration, but originally getting them to understand that we're going to take these cash equivalent currencies, give them to unknown parties, and that they might be stolen and that we couldn't account for that, that was a tough pill to swallow. And we had a lot of issues. So then we have students love this aspect of the job. There's Kirill Levchenko, who's the lead on the project, and that's Chris Canis, who is our director of purchasing. And you send this stuff out, and you do get stuff. So you get stuff. It'll be drop ship for pharmaceuticals, it's largely from India. For herbal supplements, it's largely shipped from the United States because the regulatory regime is such that there's not as much concern about shipping from within the United States. And this actually came from a little post office right next to UMass Amherst. Replica stuff comes from China primarily, and then counterfeit stuff, counterfeit software you just get online. So quick aside, this is not clearly a fraud game. So we've made over 500 orders. We also have done fake antivirus. And in all but one case, we got a shipment. That's not to say it always made it through, so about a few percent actually get picked up by customs. And I'll say the FDA was very pleased that they were getting a few percent. There's basically no fraud losses, all right? Our credit cards, because we have a separate credit card for every order and we track what happens to it over time, people are not defrauding our credit cards. There's a significant reorder business. I can tell you that more than 10% of the reorder of the business is reorders, and for Schedule II drugs in particular, it's much higher because they're seeking. And so if they find something that works, they're gonna stick with it. These people generally believe, if you listen to them talk to one another, that they are selling products of reasonable quality. I cannot talk about that categorically because we have not bought all these different products. There's a lot of legal issues about what we're allowed to buy and not allowed to buy. But I will tell you that for one drug that we bought and then we run under mass spec, here is the difference between a control and a sample. Get that? So it's not clear that this is so different. Although we did not test categorically for, like, this is testing for active ingredient. We didn't look for additives and so forth. It's not our specialty. All right. So for 3 months, we basically looked at all major spam campaigns on the Internet. We crawled basically 98% of the domains for the URLs, made multiple purchases from all of the programs. At this point, we've now made probably 30, 40 purchases from every program. And then we said, all right, let's consider interventions at each of these levels. Let's go and snip at different places. We could do it at the registrar level, at the hosting level, at the payment level. We're under a bottleneck here. First, let's look at the registrars. Now it's a problem that this doesn't work. Somehow in this conversion from PowerPoint to WebEx, something happened. So I'm going to talk to this part. What you find is that, in fact, yes, there's one registrar out of Russia that is like 40% right? 40% of domains were registered to them, and then there's another 25% registered to two domains in China, and then the tail is incredibly diverse. All right, and so this is, in some sense, suggests, hey, you know, there's a real opportunity to make impact, because you could go after a small number of registrars, three registrars, and get 50% of those domains. The downside with this point of view is that, in fact, the switching cost for those domains is incredibly low. So we did another study looking at this, where we looked at active attempts to do takedowns at the registrar level. And what you find is that people are able, because the value of a domain is about 50 cents or a dollar in bulk, and so if you take it down, that resource was not very expensive, and we have almost about 1,000 registrars and then, you know, I don't know, 5X resellers. There are so many different places they can go. So we just find, you shut them down here, they go somewhere else. And so while it's appealing from the standpoint, small number of people can have a big impact quickly, it's not a long-term impact. When you look at web hosting, it's even more diverse. You don't even get as big a concentration. And here, the switching cost is even lower. As I said, the cost per 1,000 U.S. hosts is $100, so 10 cents a host. If I shut down your name server or your web server, it's not very hard for you to get another one. So the aha moment is when you look at merchant banks. There are three banks that monetize basically all of the payments. The biggest one is Azerbaijan Bank in Azerbaijan, then one in St. Kitts and Nevis, which did most of the replica and herbal stuff, and then Dinby Nord, which did pharma, and Latvia did pharma and software. Not very many banks in general in this business, maybe 30 all told. There are, because they do, not very many banks who want to handle what are called high-risk merchants. You will not find a U.S. institution that is willingly going to offer merchant services to someone who's going to sell online pharmaceuticals. The other thing is that the switching account cost is high. You cannot, unlike domains and hosting, you can't click on a button and get it. You need to meet someone. There is due diligence that goes into this. Visa actually needs to co-sign credentials so that you can actually get your connection into VisaNet. So, you know, light speed for this system is like you create a new account in 5 days. Right, so it's just a totally different order of magnitude time. The other thing is you have to pay money to create this account. They say, okay, your high-risk account, you know, give us 20 grand. More important, though, than the upfront capital, which doesn't always have to be that big, is what's called holdback forfeiture. They know you're high-risk, so instead of paying you on net 30, they'll pay you net 90. 90 days later, you get the money. And if something bad happens and your account gets shut down, well, the bank keeps that money. So at any given point in time, they have 90 days of capital in there that will be lost if something goes wrong. So this is a really valuable resource, and it's painful to replace. And so there's a bunch of things you might, we track this to this day, we track it. Actually, every 2 weeks, we do purchase from every major program. Fake AV isn't shown here, we also do fake AV, which banks are sponsoring which activity, or not necessarily knowingly. I want to be absolutely clear about this. A number of banks do not know this is going on or are being defrauded, so we have worked with a number of them. In some cases, there's a fairly complex laundering operation going on with at least one of these that we've been working with them on. But there's a bunch of things you might do. You might go to the merchant banks and say, hey, you should drop these customers. This is they're violating U.S. law and visa regulations. There are some challenges too. You have to do this bilaterally. It's going to work on human time scales. You could also do it on the issuing side. That is, when you get your credit card as a U.S. citizen, like from Chase or Wells Fargo or whatnot, they can block the transaction as well. And in fact, the nice part about doing it on the issuing side is it's just like blacklisting of anything. You could do it arbitrarily cheap and do it unilaterally. And you know, 50% of U.S. credit cards are issued by about 5 banks. So there's a capacity. Now, there's a challenge here. The incentives aren't aligned. It's not costing them anything. From their standpoint, there's no fraud. Their customers aren't hurting. They got burned when they were forced to do this for gambling, and so this is not necessarily their favorite bunch of activity. But the point is that there are policy things one could do here. And I'm actually going to talk really briefly about that in the last minute, which is, so we have had success in doing this. So we got some major press, front page of the Science section, and then the New York Times ran an op-ed basically saying, and you should do that. That thing that they said, that would be a good idea for someone to do. We gave a lot of briefings to both government agencies, oddly enough, there's all kinds of communities who are interested in this stuff. We gave support to law enforcement community, industry, banks, investigations, pharma. In the end, there are lots of people who are interested. Not all of them feel that they're in a position to act, so the community that was easiest to act with the brand holders. And so there's actually a major initiative now underway. It just launched yesterday between the International Anti-Counterfeiting Coalition with, I think, some organizational help from the Executive Office of the President in the Intellectual Property section that is doing exactly this, all right, where they're allowing brands to come in, provide information, and trying to shut down the merchant accounts associated with that. So over the course of the next 6 months, we'll have some idea about how effective this is, and we're actually working with a number of these outfits to do that work. So, sum up, our work, basically, we're big believers that security should be data-driven, and that if you're going to do this, you should be gathering data not simply about the purely technical characteristics, but about the economic and social structure. And there's a real achievable research agenda here. I've only touched on one aspect of it, but we've done stuff on the nature of reputation, underground social networks, and third world labor, and so forth. There's a lot of work that can be done here. And it's a place where one can have more meaningful impact than I think was easy to have on purely the technical side. And thank you very much.
So I lied. He did talk about some of his interesting work. And you understand why I gave him such a short introduction, because I didn't want to take any time away from that. But we do have time for questions, and we can also, I think, accept questions from people who are on WebEx. And I also, before I forget again, is we will be going to lunch with Stefan afterwards. Anyone wants to join us who's here is welcome to come along.
So Bitcoin.
Sure. So the question was about pure online forms of payment like Bitcoin, and were they to succeed, wouldn't that undermine this choke point because it's not going through the traditional payment networks? And I think that if you were to take that to its logical conclusion, that you're right, Bitcoin is a kind of an invented payment mechanism that offers a lot of anonymity and is independent of any central broker. I will be shocked if in my lifetime that it is a reasonable replacement. The reason, again, is not that individuals can't learn to use Bitcoin. It's that you're trying to reach the broad U.S. consumer market. All right, so imagine you're trying to get all of your relatives to use Bitcoin as a matter of course. The only payment instrument that has a footprint of any reasonable size in the West are the big payment card networks. And so, you know, regardless of what you think about this action, I mean, were it true that you could replace it with something else, WikiLeaks would not be having problems because their credit card transactions have been shut down. They would have found one of these alternatives. In fact, it's quite challenging to find these alternatives. It's not impossible, but I think it's hard to do at scale, which is what the problem is here. Yes?
You mentioned that there were three registrars that were at the center, and you also made the point that if they were shut down, the switching cost would be less. I'm curious about those three registrars. I live in the world of those registrars, and they're divided into two broad categories, those that are have a contractual relationship with ICANN
and those that don't. All registrars have to have a contractual relationship with ICANN, otherwise they can't operate.
Wrong.
They
just very briefly, the world's divided into so-called generic registries and registrars that serve those, and then country code registries, and there are registrars that only deal with those.
Yep.
And those are not regulated for having a contractual.
It's just, okay.
Well, that's not the whole business. But the three that you're talking about are ones that you think that do fall under the...
Let me speak to this. The question is really about what kind of registries are we dealing with? Are these people who are serving up things like .com
right.
and .net, or are they serving up country codes, TLDs like .ru and .cn?
Yeah.
And the dominant ones at the time were .ru and .cn. But I don't think that the reason is principally because those registries have less oversight than VeriSign, although they do. You're quite right. They're independent. They have more independence. They still need a contractual relationship with ICANN, but they're more independent. But I think that the real issue is the cost structure. So we found this fascinating thing. It used to be that .cn was by far the most popular domain for people to spam with, and it was because there was a campaign that the Chinese government did and was run through CNNIC, where the cost of a .cn domain was 1 RMB, which is about 10 cents, and was by far the cheapest domain in existence. And so what happened just recently, actually about a year and a half ago, is they changed the requirements to require quite a bit of documentation if you wanted to register a .cn, which in turn raised the cost for registrars who wanted to offer .cn in China, and it raised the price to about 67 RMB, which is about 10 bucks. And so it became much less attractive because it's a more expensive resource. And what happened, there is a perfect tracking of the decline slope in the use of .cn and the rise of .ru, which was the next cheapest domain that's available. So I think that the cost is what draws people to particular registries. Now, what brings them to particular registrars, I think, is people who are willing to bulk register and look the other way about the fact that you're registering 100,000 random character domains, and maybe I should wonder about what your business is. Another question? I see a question from Keith.
I have a question. Okay,
this is a bold experiment. Oh, okay.
You talked about the work needed to get your university on board with your research plan. What other obstacles are there for people who wish to jump into this line of research?
Keith was my chair at the time, so he's well aware of the problems that we had. So I think that there are both institutional challenges to overcome, and we've written some papers on what some of those are. And actually, I'm happy to talk with any research groups who want to be in this space, because there's a fair amount of trust building that has to happen piecemeal with your university. The other thing is that you need, so for example, I have very little data of my own, all right? I have some data from these bots that we run and then from things that we visit, but there's a huge amount of data that we get from others. And those others may be independent investigators, they may be industry, they may be organizations in other countries. And a lot of them don't just ask them for data. In fact, when we started this enterprise with Seaside, we approached all kinds of people for data and they laughed at us. And it took quite some time of kind of building up trust to the point where they were willing to share data with us, which is pretty essential for doing this work. And so I think that another big obstacle is getting them, I wouldn't phrase it as getting them access to data because I don't think that's a directly solvable problem, but it's helping them learn how to build up trust in those communities. And some of it is getting to know those communities. They don't come to the academic conferences to find out about your work. You have to go to them. And so there are a lot of things that you need to do to engage the people who actually have the data required to allow you to do the research.
Yeah. Question that someone can ask here is, does it provide a business product?
Well, I would hesitate to generalize from that. But for replica watches is a great example, because they're right up front. They say it's a replica. Okay, so continue your question.
So, yeah, I guess the question is,
all right, so the question is twofold. One is, if this is not a fraudulent activity, then where's the harm? And the other is, what's the cost associated with spam? So let me deal with the second one first, and then I'll get to the first one. So the cost is a bunch of ways you can talk about cost. We have direct costs that we pay simply because we spend $1 billion a year on anti-spam. All right? So that cost has to be borne somehow. Right? It's just, that's the tax that we pay for the spam problem and supporting the anti-spam industry. There's indirect costs that come about because you actually have to, when the stuff gets through your filters, you have to look at it and so forth. And so people have tried to come up with estimates of what that is in labor costs and so forth. But then the thing I'll point out is that not all spam is used for goods, right? So in previous work, we studied the Storm botnet, which had taken over several hundred thousand hosts and spread almost exclusively through using spam as a vector to attract you to sites that would compromise you. And so spam as a vector for malware, for phishing, for all kinds of other activity that do have direct harm is still fairly important. Right? It may not dominate the amount of spam out there, but I would not want to let spam go. There are definitely cases, and this is in fact why we have laws on the books, of people getting bad drugs that have killed them. All right, so there is a public health issue here because there is no QA on the pharmaceutical stuff. I think those are the principal kind of cost issues that come to mind. On the what's the harm part, I think it really comes down to what, aside from the public health aspect, it comes down to what is your view on intellectual property crime. All right? So I'll tell you, if you are Microsoft or Adobe, you don't like the fact that people download your software for free and don't pay you any money. That doesn't support your business model. And I think that you would find some lawyers for Rolex and Movado and Pfizer who feel fairly strongly the same way, regardless. And so let's put aside the pharma thing. I think that the standpoint that the Rolex guy would make is, look, this is our brand. We built it. We have a culture in which you get valued for brand, and so I need to find a way to maintain that value. And that really comes down to how you feel about that issue.
Okay, well, if there's no further questions, let's thank Stephan again.
Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
That concludes today's conference. Thank you for participating. You may now disconnect.